7 out of 100 simulations, Donald Trump wins. What this means is that it is a toss-up. What this means is that exactly what I have been saying, those who are confidently declaring that Biden obviously will win are not basing their projection in reality. Those who are confidently projecting that it is Donald Trump who will win are not basing their projection in reality, and that this is likely to come down to a relatively small number of votes in a small number of states. Now, let's dig into the simulation a little bit more deeply. As you can see here, there is a sort of distribution curve, and I'll describe what we're looking at for people who are only listening. There's a distribution curve of possible outcomes, and as you can see, they are really grouped right around the middle. You could make the case that there are more scenarios in which Trump wins. This isn't really an accurate interpretation of this model. What the model does suggest is that some of Trump's paths to 270 electoral votes include a larger margin of victory than some of Biden's. And that's by the very nature of which states are definitely going to go Biden and Trump, and sort of the realities of that. If you're interested in seeing the full list of polls that 538 uses in making these projections, you can do that. It's not super relevant to our discussion today. One of the interesting things is where how has the forecast changed over time? Now, what's interesting about this is that they only just now are issuing their full projection, but you can back out some of this data. And what you can see if you go back is that there was a period where it seemed as though Biden was likely to come away with more electoral votes than he is right now. But the scenario that in this 53-47 margin, 538 says is the most likely right now is Biden 275 and Trump 263. Remember, 270 is the line between winning and losing. And so that is a very, very, very small margin, significantly smaller than it was in 2020. So if you're trying to figure out how important is it that I vote generically, obviously, the truth is because of the Electoral College, if you vote in California, it's less important that you vote than it is if you vote in North Carolina or even more Wisconsin or even more Arizona. We've talked about that, and that's part of why I'm against the Electoral College. But it is the system we have, and that's the one that we will be fighting this election over. But importantly, expecting a tighter electoral margin than in 2020 in terms of what are the critical toss-up states. They are, as I've been saying, Arizona, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Georgia. It is those five. And with those five, potentially hangs in the balance who will be the next president of the United States. What are the closest races? The closest ones, according to this model, are Arizona, Nevada, Georgia, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan. All of those are under a 2-point margin. And then you get to larger margins. And then you can look at a whole bunch of other scenarios here. What's the takeaway here? There is one and only one takeaway, which is to pat me on the back and to say, you know what, David, you're right. This is probably going to be close. And I'm, of course, kidding. There's nothing particularly stunning or difficult about my prediction, which is elections in the United States, given the hyperpolarized nature of the country. Given that if you put an R or a D in front of a candidate's name, that gets you the lion's share of your potential vote. And then the rest is just sort of like, who can you convince from this much smaller group that might go one way and might go the other way? In addition to this, we have the reality that because we have no national popular vote contest, these are 50 individual popular vote contests, which then inform the Electoral College. A large swath of the country kind of doesn't matter because the partisan demographics are so skewed one way or the other. Although someday Texas may be close and may be in play for Democrats, we would love it to be. It's not in play this year. California is not in play this year. It's going to go to Democrats, period. So we end up with a scenario where really this is an election that will be decided by those voters in five or so states who are considering, I might vote, I might stay home. I might vote for Biden, or I might vote for Trump, or I might vote third party or write somebody else in. So a country of 340 million. You obviously reduce that to the number of eligible voters. You then reduce that to the 60 or so percent that we expect to vote. And then you reduce this to the swing voters in the five key states. How many voters does this election depend on?
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Eid is today, but the warplanes haven't stopped all night. What Eid? In all the Arab countries, people are celebrating Eid and enjoying it in their countries, and they're having a good time. But what about us? Where is our Eid? At war? In destruction?
The Israeli military announces a daytime tactical pause in its attacks on Rafah to allow humanitarian aid to enter the Strip after systematically blocking aid from reaching Palestinians in Gaza for 8 months. But UNRWA says that nothing has changed. We'll go to Rafah for an update from UNICEF spokesperson James Elder. Then former President Trump hits the campaign trail after visiting top Republicans at the Capitol for the first time since January 6th.
First day in office, we're going to close up the border. First day in office, we're going to drill, baby, drill.
We'll get response from Democratic Congress member Jamie Raskin, who served on the Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack and calls Trump's meetings with Republican leaders a scandal and a disgrace. And acclaimed author Arundhati Roy could soon face trial under India's contested anti-terror laws after Prime Minister Narendra Modi's far-right ruling BJP party gave the go-ahead for her prosecution.
India's constitution has effectively been set aside. The Indian Penal Code is being rewritten. If the current regime wins a majority in 2024, it is very likely we will see a new constitution.
The charges against Arundhati Roy stem from comments she made about Kashmir in 2010, but supporters say this is an attack on free speech. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations warning more than 50,000 Palestinian children in Gaza require immediate medical treatment for acute malnutrition. In a statement, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees said the situation in Gaza is catastrophic as residents continue to face desperate levels of hunger. Muslims across the world today are marking the holy day of Eid al-Adha, but it is a day of mourning in Gaza, where the death toll from Israel's war has topped 37,300.
How are we supposed to be happy on Eid? While every day there are martyrs, wounded people every minute, every second, there are no houses. This area used to be the best area in Khan Yunis. Now it's all destruction and rubble. Now our biggest dream is to live in a house. There are no houses and no life. Life has been diminished.
A new investigation by the Associated Press has revealed at least 60 Palestinian families have lost 25 or more family members in Israel's ongoing war. In some cases, entire bloodlines of families have been killed. AP highlights the story of Yusuf Salem. 173 of his relatives were killed in Israeli airstrikes in December. About 100 more members of his family have died since then. Yusuf Salem told the AP, quote, "My uncles were wiped out totally, the heads of households, their wives, children and grandchildren," unquote. In more news from Gaza, aid shipments are no longer coming in by sea to Gaza. The U.S. military's temporarily removed the pier it just built due to rough seas at the cost of over $300 million, the building of that pier. This comes just over a week after the pier was reattached, after the first pier was damaged in a storm. Meanwhile, on Sunday, Israel announced it would pause attacks along an aid route in southern Gaza during daylight hours. But the head of UNRWA says operationally nothing's changed in southern Gaza. Israel's announcement came a day after fighters from Hamas killed 8 Israeli soldiers in Rafah in an ambush. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has dissolved Israel's war cabinet following the recent resignation of former military chief Benny Gantz. This comes as mass protests continue in Israel, calling for the government to support a ceasefire and hostage deal and for new elections. Tens of thousands of people protested in Tel Aviv Saturday. Several groups have vowed to intensify their protests by launching what they call a week of resistance. Here in the United States, Democratic Congressmember Ro Khanna of California has announced he'll join other lawmakers and boycott Netanyahu's upcoming speech to Congress. The Biden administration's placed sanctions on a far-right Israeli group that's been attacking Gaza-bound humanitarian aid trucks in the West Bank. In May, members of the group Tzav 9 set fire to two aid trucks and looted the aid aboard the trucks. In other news from the occupied West Bank, Norway's foreign minister has warned the Palestinian Authority could collapse in the coming months due to a lack of funding. In a 6-3 ruling, the U.S. Supreme Court has struck down a ban on bump stocks, accessories that turn semi-automatic rifles like the AR-15 into fully automatic machine guns. The Trump administration issued the ban in 2018 after a gunman opened fire at a concert in Las Vegas, killing 58 people in one of the country's deadliest mass shootings ever. In the majority opinion, Justice Clarence Thomas wrote, quote, "We hold that a semi-automatic rifle equipped with a bump stock is not a machine gun because it cannot fire more than one shot by a single function of the trigger," unquote. The court's three liberal judges dissented. Justice Sonia Sotomayor summarized her dissent from the bench, saying, quote, "The majority puts machine guns back in civilian hands. When I see a bird that walks like a duck, swims like a duck, quacks like a duck, I call that bird a duck," she said. Survivors of the 2017 Las Vegas massacre decried the Supreme Court decision.
I'm going to let our children continue to die. You know, that's my biggest push, is that as an adult, I am stuck with this trauma and this fear for the rest of my life. My children should not have to live this way. You know, we don't have to live this way, and we don't have to die this way.
In related news, a gunman in Rochester Hills, Michigan, opened fire at a splash pad on Saturday afternoon. Nine people were injured, including two children and a pregnant woman. The victims ranged in age from 4 to 78. A semi-automatic handgun was found at the scene. The suspected gunman was later found dead from an apparent self-inflicted gunshot wound. The shooting occurred in the same county as the 2021 mass shooting at Oxford High School that left 4 students dead. More than 90 countries participated in a 2-day conference in Switzerland to discuss ways to end Russia's war in Ukraine, but Russia wasn't invited to attend the talks. Most of the countries attending signed a joint communique stating the, quote, "territorial integrity of Ukraine must be the basis of any peace deal." Ahead of the talks, Russian President Vladimir Putin put forward his own ceasefire proposal that involved Ukraine dropping its ambitions to join NATO and to hand over areas of Ukraine claimed by Moscow. Speaking in Switzerland, Vice President Kamala Harris criticized Putin's offer.
"And let nothing about the end of this war be decided without Ukraine. By contrast, however, yesterday, Putin put forward a proposal. But we must speak truth. He is not calling for negotiations. He is calling for surrender."
The UN is imploring the international community to pay more attention to the unfolding humanitarian catastrophe in Sudan, where the war that broke out last April has killed at least 14,000 people, uprooted over 10 million, could result in millions of famine-related deaths. Humanitarian groups project 750,000 people could face catastrophic food shortages by September, while some analysts say the death toll could end up in the millions. This comes amidst ongoing deadly battles in El Fasher, as the rapid support forces try to seize the last city in Darfur outside its control. Over 220 people have been killed in recent fighting. Last week, the UN Security Council passed a resolution calling on the RSF to immediately halt its attack on El Fasher. In France, leftist parties announced a new alliance ahead of snap elections later this month. French President Emmanuel Macron called the surprise June 30th vote after suffering a major defeat to the far-right national rally at the EU elections. Leaders of the newly formed New Popular Front joined mass protests against the rise of the far right in Paris Saturday, vowing a complete break with Macron's policies.
Popular mobilization is the key to fight against the extreme right and to beat the extreme right. We say regularly that the European elections mark the after Macron period.
The United States is driving a global surge in spending on nuclear weapons. The International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons reports global spending on nukes jumped 13% to over $91 billion last year. The United States spent over $51 billion modernizing its nuclear arsenal. That's more money than all of the other nuclear nations spent last year combined. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa has been reelected for a second term after his African National Congress managed to put together South Africa's first coalition government. The coalition includes the Democratic Alliance, the ANC's longtime rival. The ANC suffered a major defeat in the recent election when it lost its majority in parliament for the first time since the end of apartheid 30 years ago. Reuters has revealed the U.S. military ran a secret anti-vaccination campaign during the pandemic in the Philippines and other nations in an effort to sow doubt about COVID vaccines made by China. The Pentagon campaign began in 2020 under Donald Trump and continued into mid-2021 after Joe Biden took office. The Pentagon set up numerous fake social media accounts on multiple platforms to target audiences in the Philippines, Central Asia, and the Middle East. The campaign also aimed to discredit masks and test kits made in China. One military officer involved in the campaign told Reuters, quote, "We weren't looking at this from a public health perspective. We were looking at how we could drag China through the mud," they said. A judge in Missouri has overturned the conviction of a woman who spent 43 years in prison for a murder she did not commit. 63-year-old Sandra Hem is believed to have been jailed longer than any other woman who was wrongfully convicted in the United States. She was convicted of killing a librarian in 1980 solely based on self-incriminating statements she made to police at a time when she was a patient at a psychiatric hospital where she was being treated for auditory hallucinations and drug use. Evidence has since emerged showing the actual murderer was a police officer who has since died. The governor of Maryland is planning today to pardon 175,000 marijuana convictions. The sweeping move by Governor Wes Moore is expected to help about 100,000 people who were arrested on low-level drug charges. In an interview with The Washington Post, Governor Moore said, quote, "I'm ecstatic that we have a real opportunity with what I'm signing to right a lot of historical wrongs," unquote. Governor Moore said he timed pardons for the week of Juneteenth, the federal holiday on June 19th to mark the end of slavery in the United States. The U.S. Surgeon General is calling on Congress to require social media platforms to include warnings stating that their apps can cause, quote, significant mental health harms for adolescents, unquote. In an op-ed for The New York Times, Dr. Vivek Murthy wrote, quote, "Evidence from tobacco studies show that warning labels can increase awareness and change behavior." Climate activists in Europe are denouncing G7 leaders for not doing more to address the climate emergency. During the recent summit in Italy, G7 leaders committed to accelerating the transition away from fossil fuels. Activists with the group Extinction Rebellion chained themselves together in Bari, Italy.
"We call for this voice to be heard, that of the animals that are disappearing, of the biodiversity that is dying, and also of the people who are living in the front line of the eco-climate crisis. Because international forums such as the G7 are not taking concrete action. Instead, they're going in the opposite direction. Even though international institutes such as the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change or the International Energy Agency have repeatedly said that a transition is possible, even while respecting the rights of people and workers, G7 countries continue to invest in fossil gas, like Italy, in oil, like the U.S., in coal, like Japan or France and Germany."
And the University of Minnesota has announced it'll launch a new search for the new next director of its Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies after rescinding its offer to noted historian Professor Roz Siegel. The center revoked its job offer to Siegel, who is an Israeli Jew, after two members of its advisory board resigned to protest his hiring, who has called Israel's war on Gaza, quote, a textbook case of genocide. Hundreds of professors have signed a letter condemning the university's decision. You can see our interview with Professor Siegel at democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show in Gaza, where the United Nations and other organizations are issuing ever dire warnings as Israel's assault stretches into its ninth month. The head of the World Health Organization, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, warned last week, quote, a significant proportion of Gaza's population is now facing catastrophic hunger and famine-like conditions. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, says over 50,000 children now require immediate medical treatment for acute malnutrition. Medical workers are struggling to treat sick and malnourished patients and Israel's destruction of Gaza's health infrastructure and water supply. On Sunday, the Israeli military announced a daytime tactical pause in its attacks on Rafah to allow humanitarian aid to enter the Strip. But the head of UNRWA says operationally nothing has changed in southern Gaza. Israel has been systematically blocking aid from reaching Palestinians in Gaza for the last 8 months. Israeli forces have also targeted Palestinians seeking the scarce aid and have killed more aid workers than any war since the UN was formed. Israeli forces have also killed Palestinians as they attempt to bring food home to their families, including last Wednesday, when troops fired at a group of fishermen in Gaza, killing two of them. That attack was witnessed by our next guest, UNICEF spokesperson James Elder, who's joining us now from Rafah. Before we get to that larger issue, can you describe what you saw? What happened to these fishermen, James Elder?
Amy, we're on a mission to take, life-saving medical and nutritional supplies for UNICEF to 10,000 children in the north. We've gone through all the processes. It's very complicated. It's detailed. We've seen far, far too much aid denied and restricted for people who are in such desperate growing need. It's about a 25-mile journey from where we were, Derybala, to the north, to Gaza City. Amy, it took us 13 hours, 8 hours of those were near checkpoints. In the end, there was a who said, she said on our truck was enclosed. They thought it was a van. We waited, we waited, we waited. In the end, it was denied that access. We were unable to get those supplies to those 10,000 children. As we waited, Amy, ironically, I'd been talking to a colleague about the fishing industry, about, you know, this destruction of education, of healthcare, of housing, of agriculture. This colleague, friend of mine, explained how his father-in-law had a fishing business, and he showed me videos of when his fishing business, the boats, when they just went up in flames, when they were bombed or missiled, boats, wood, and of course, fuel. And he showed me this. He explained his father-in-law had a stroke at this time. So I was engrossed watching these fishermen. This was just 8 or 10 men in knee-deep water, in the ocean or in the sea, with a single net each. And I was looking at each one thinking, you were probably a university professor, you were maybe an engineer. Watching for hours and hours whilst we waited to get our aid. Suddenly, there was a tank. This was very near the Israeli large military checkpoint. There was gunfire. Next thing, two of the fishermen just up on the beach were on the sand. Now, I was luckily with other colleagues, World Health Organization, a paramedic. They immediately rang to the authorities to get us permission, those people with emergency medical experience, get us permission to get onto the beach to see the state of these two fishermen. That was denied. That access was denied. Half an hour later, the other fishermen, just so desperate to get to see their friends, their family, I'm not sure, in the air, we gave them body bags. They went, they brought them back, and that's where I saw that one fisherman had been shot in the back and one fisherman still with the fishing net around his ankle had been shot in the neck.
So if you can put this into a bigger context, James Elder, if you can talk about what's happening right now, the scale of the catastrophe that is Gaza right now when it comes to hunger and famine, not to mention the killing of Palestinians, where what? Right now, the number is over 37,000 killed, well over 15,000 children, probably the number much higher because we don't know how many people are dead under the rubble.
Well, as you say, Amy, look at that number of children. I don't know what number. My executive director, I think, captured it very well to the Security Council many months ago, saying that the killing of children in Gaza and the destruction of Gaza cannot possibly bring peace to the Middle East. We are now at this terrifying time where it seems like it's being normalized. There is nothing normal about another night here where the bombardments are relentless, the drones are relentless. You do not sleep. OK, obviously, children get bombed as well, but there is no, the psychological torment of that. That's ongoing. Just before we started, I heard more fire here, more bombardments. That will be relentless. So 250 days, Amy, children have gone through this. The physical and psychological exhaustion they face is, yes, almost impossible to capture. Because on top of that, you have a nutritional crisis like the Gaza Strip has never seen before. And that's why we're trying to deliver aid to the north. You have a water desperation that we have not seen here. That normally 15 litres of water is a bare minimum per person, and a bare minimum, that's to clean, to drink, to wash. We're down to a couple of litres of water. It's the middle of summer here. It's sweltering heat. I looked at a thermometer in a tent the other day. It was 55 degrees Celsius. I don't know what that is. It's way above 100 Fahrenheit. Yes, people in Gaza are used to the summer. They're used to summer in their own homes with a cross breeze, with ceiling fans. Now they are in tents, side by side, sweltering on the sand. So that lack of water and lack of food is not just playing into disease on those most vulnerable being children. It's also now we just have sheer risk of dehydration. So from the skies, it is relentless. I was at a hospital just a couple of hours ago before speaking with you, European hospital. Within a moment, I see Hala, 4 years old. She's blind in one eye after the family home was struck. Wahid has lost his arm and his leg after he was asleep and he woke up in rubble. And Yassim has lost his right arm. This is within a minute of seeing it. There are, I don't know what it is now. I got numbers when I was here in November, Amy, 1,000 children with amputations. I don't know the number now. We should stop these numbers. We have to focus on that human story. But, of course, the scale is unprecedented, and as hard as it is to believe, it continues. And of course, people ask, is it worse now? Of course it's worse. It's worse every day. It can't not be. Today, it will be a bombardment. Today, we'll be more people without food and water. Tomorrow will be worse. It will continue to get worse until those with the power of the pen, those looking over this ceasefire, start to understand and start to care about the level of suffering that children and their families are enduring here.
You mentioned 55 degrees Celsius when you looked at the thermometer. That's actually 131 degrees Fahrenheit. We're talking to James Elder, UNICEF spokesperson, the United Nations International Children's Emergency Fund. He is joining us from Rafah, Gaza. You just said that you continue to hear explosions outside. So can you talk about what this tactical pause is that the Israeli military surprisingly announced kind of out of the blue on Sunday? What exactly it means? It says around one emergency aid route in Rafah?
Yes. Look, any restriction in bombing, any pause in the bombing is good news for children. There are most nights here, they're almost sleepless nights, whether it's the bombing or whether it's the drones. A bombing is like, if it's close, I thought I knew, Amy, what bombing sounded like. I had no idea. When it's really close, it's like someone banging pots next to your head. A drone is a lawnmower, and it's relentless. There are attack drones and there are surveillance drones, and there's more fire now. So any restriction in bombing, any pause, whatever you want to call it, is good news for children. But we have to wait and see what this will actually mean. This is a small portion of getting aid in through one part of the Gaza Strip. Now, to facilitate aid is good, but a much bigger picture than that, the responsibility of Israel as the occupying power is to enable aid to be distributed safely on the Gaza Strip. That's not happening. Chaos is being sown because there is such high levels of desperation, because there is such a lack of security. As you said rightly, Amy, there, more United Nations colleagues haven't been killed in this war than at any time since the advent of the United Nations. So whether this will mean smoother, faster, safer aid operations, we hope so. But what will really that to truly happen would be more crossings opening, many more crossings opening. We've been speaking about that, the Secretary General of the United Nations, for months and months and months. That's one part of it. The second part is, of course, just we go back to a ceasefire. Ceasefire is flooding the Gaza Strip with aid, getting hostages home. Ceasefire would get hostages home, and a ceasefire would enable us to start to address the nutritional crisis. For example, Amy, UNICEF was treating 3,000 children with the most dangerous form of malnutrition here in Rafah. And then we had the military offensive in Rafah that we all begged not to happen but somehow feared would. That quote-unquote limited offensive that led to a million people being displaced, it also meant that our stabilisation centre there, treating 3,000 children, was inoperable in a minute. Children getting treatment suddenly, and they're gone. Now we have to try and go back into those communities, back into these tented hell holes, to find these children, to find those families, because without that treatment, they will die. And Rafah Crossing, which was the lifeline, Rafah Crossing was the lifeline for humanitarian aid, has been closed for more than a month now. So there's such a constant war of words here, but we just need to look at evidence. Evidence is that humanitarian trucks coming in May was half that of April. Evidence is there's a fraction of routes open that should be. Land crossings are the most efficient and cost-effective way to get aid in. Evidence is that the pier is no longer functioning. Evidence is that we are catapulting, if you will, into a nutritional crisis. And the evidence is that as we try to deliver aid and as children try to be safe, bombardments continue.
You have talked about what's happening in Gaza as a war on children. Earlier this month, UN added Israel to its so-called list of shame, a blacklist of nations and groups that violate the rights of children in armed conflicts. Other nations on the UN list of shame are Russia, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Somalia, Syria, Burma, Afghanistan, Haiti. UN also adding Hamas and Islamic Jihad to that list of shame. Can you explain practically what this means? And also, as you talk about children facing hunger, of course, adults too, what are the long-term effects of this?
Yeah, I think three parts of it. The UNICEF and the United Nations absolutely stands by that data and the robustness of that data. It is the Secretary General's report, and I would have to leave it to their office to speak more to it. But yes, we do, and we have for many months called this a war on children. And like everything here, we do that based on evidence. We don't do that seeking a headline. We do that because of all the conflicts where UNICEF operates, from all the front lines, from Afghanistan to Yemen to Ukraine to Syria, we have not seen the percentage of civilians injured, maimed, killed as high as on children as here. That's why the evidence speaks to this being a war on children. And yes, that is because there's a large child population and it's a dense population. It's also because we have continuously seen an indiscriminate nature of bombings. On Tuesday, when I was at Al-Aqsa Hospital in the middle area, how many families I speak to, and again, sometimes, Amy, I go into a hospital and literally, right, I'm going to talk to the first person I see. And there are thousands of people. There are children on the floor needing attention despite the best, brave, selfless efforts of doctors working 24 hours a day who at the same time are thinking, how do I get wood and water to my family tonight? First family I saw was a little boy, Ali. Ali was asleep in the third floor of his family home when a missile struck. Next thing, he's in the rubble on the ground floor. I then learned that Ali's mother was also in that bombing, that attack on the family home. I found her in the hospital. And I wanted to explain that I'd found Ali and so on. I thought I actually had good news for a millisecond. I thought in this darkness I had something to share. In fact, she was aware that Ali was there, but she also explained that her two other children had been killed in that bomb attack. These are ongoing. Yeah, last night, tonight. So that's the indiscriminate nature of this war that continues. Of a nutritional crisis, I'm sorry, you have to repeat that last part of your question.
the effects, the long-term effects of hunger on children?
Yeah, unfortunately, UNICEF has learned this because we operate north to south, south to east, on the east to west, rather, around the world. They are many, and they worsen, just like trauma worsens nutritional status of a child. If the longer it is left unattended, the worse it gets. And in the youngest children, if we obviously the greatest risk is death, and a severely malnourished child is 10 times more likely to die from a common illness. And my goodness, there are common illnesses here because of the deprivation of sanitation and water. But there are also risks to mental development. There are great risks to physical growth and psychological growth, mental development. Now, that impact long-term is on the society, is on their community, is on their income potential. All right, and that may sound like a long way off. It shouldn't be. UNICEF is always looking at the whole age bracket of a child. And if we look here in Gaza, this young child population, any economist, any demographer will tell you, you get this right with a young child population. And it's not hard. You have the right training, the right skills, the right opportunity, and you have a demographic boom. You have the envy of aging populations. You get it wrong, and you have all the attendant risks of security and everything else that goes with it. And this is a paradigm example of getting it wrong.
Finally, James Elder, going back to that issue of a ceasefire, what exactly that would mean?
It means everything, Amy. It means everything. There's times my own voice that I've heard myself and feel tired saying it, much less what people must think. But when you're in Gaza and you still feel that hope among people, the number of women, I was with a meeting a man just earlier near the water, and he explained, he has moved eight times he's moved, and he's well versed on all the Security Council resolutions in this current one. And his words to me were, we must continue to hope, but this feels like our last hope. And I understand that the decay of the psychological state, people are just holding on. I've had many women say to me words to the effect of, well, my husband's been killed, my home was destroyed, I've lost the ability to feed my children, and I've lost my job. All I have left is hope. So they are holding on to hope, but they're also aware that some of them have lost count of how many of these resolutions there are. But a ceasefire means, in the most simple sense, hostages go home. That torment ends. It means a mother will promise her child, as a mother said to me, exactly these words, I will be able to go to bed that night with my child and promise her she can wake up. You can't do that here. As many people have said to me, living or dying is luck. It is luck here, given the indiscriminate nature. So a ceasefire for those with the power, the military aims, whatever they are, have created this war on children. Those with the power on this ceasefire, they need, as I say, they need to understand the suffering here. And as many Gazans are saying, this does feel like their last hope.
James Elder, UNICEF spokesperson. UNICEF is the United Nations International Children's Emergency Fund, joining us from Rafah, Gaza. Next up, former President Trump just met with top Republicans at the Capitol for the first time since January 6. We'll get response from Democratic Congressmember Jamie Raskin, who served on the Select Committee to investigate the January 6 attack. We'll also talk about the Supreme Court. And we'll talk about Gaza. Stay with us.
Keep your key. You're gonna need it to come back home. I'm always free. I'm here to remind you, you're never alone. It's hard to say that I've been okay. Every now and then I hear you call my name. So keep your key. You're gonna need it to come back home. Keep your key.
Your Key by El Noor. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump hit the campaign trail in the battleground state of Michigan Saturday to address black voters in Detroit. He also attended a conference of the right-wing Get Out the Vote group Turning Point USA.
First day in office, we're going to close up the border. First day in office, we're going to drill, baby, drill.
This comes after Trump returned to the U.S. Capitol Thursday for the first time since the January 6, 2021 insurrection. Trump met with Republican lawmakers, including House Speaker Mike Johnson, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, and Senator Mitt Romney. Politico reports Trump asked Johnson for help to overturn his conviction of 34 felonies in New York and to help punish the Justice Department. Our next guest has called Republican leaders' meetings with Trump a scandal and a disgrace. Yes, that's Democratic Congressmember Jamie Raskin, who served on the Select Committee to investigate the January 6 attack on the U.S. Capitol and was the lead impeachment manager in the second impeachment trial of former President Trump. He's the author of Unthinkable: Trauma, Truth, and the Trials of American Democracy. Congressmember Raskin, welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Why don't you just talk about the significance of that meeting that might have gone under the radar for some, what it meant for Trump to return to the Capitol, and the lining up of his even previous critics behind him.
Well, Amy, thank you for having me. It's a real pleasure to be back with you on your show. For Trump, I imagine he experienced it as a triumphant moment. He was last seen in disgrace and infamy after he incited a violent insurrection against the union to surround and prop up his inside political coup, where he tried to get Vice President Pence to step outside of his constitutional role and simply declare Trump the victor in a presidential election that Trump lost by more than 7 million votes, 306 to 232 in the Electoral College. But his return to Capitol Hill showed that he has cemented his political stranglehold over the Republican Party. And members of Congress who had criticized him, some of whom even seemed to have made a permanent break with him, like Lindsey Graham, after the insurrection, are now completely back in the fold. And we see the way that Donald Trump operates, much as J.D. Vance once described it back when he was not in the cult, as a form of cultural and political heroin. They're acting like addicts, and they're acting like cult members, which make the stakes of this election awfully clear for everybody else.
Oh, you mentioned J.D. Vance, top contender for vice presidential running mate of President Trump. Also, the return to the Capitol. I mean, so many of the insurrectionists who've been arrested, who've been jailed, are not allowed to return there, but President Trump is.
Well, Trump is busy pardoning everybody he can. I mean, he pardoned before he left office Michael Flynn, Roger Stone, Paul Manafort, Dinesh D'Souza, Steve Bannon, Joe Arpaio. These people are the inner coterie of his political campaign in 2024. And now he's promising to pardon hundreds of shock troops on the extreme right, people from the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers and other extremist groups who attacked Capitol officers, Metropolitan Police Department officers, officers from Montgomery County, Maryland, the jurisdiction I represent in Congress. And these are people who violently assaulted officers and deliberately tried to stop the steal, which means to interfere with the counting of Electoral College votes and to accomplish the peaceful transfer of power. He is running around the country saying he's going to pardon these, quote, political prisoners or hostages. A hostage, of course, is someone who's been illegally abducted by a terrorist group like Hamas or a criminal group, and then held for a financial or a political ransom. And he is treating people who are violent lawbreakers and insurrectionists, seditionists to the American Republic as hostages or political prisoners. And so, again, he continues to set himself at war against our constitutional order.
Can you explain his request to the House Speaker Johnson about trying to go after the Justice Department to reverse the guilty verdict for the 34 felonies he was found guilty of here in New York?
Yeah, well, I don't know if Donald Trump actually understands the difference between the federal system and the state system. They have been roundly denouncing the Department of Justice, which is a huge irony, given that it's the Department of Justice that just prosecuted and succeeded in convicting Hunter Biden on his gun charges and is busy prosecuting a U.S. senator who's a Democrat from New Jersey and a Democratic representative from Texas on various charges. But in any event, you know, when, you know, Donald Trump's like a dog with a bone, and now he can't stand the fact that he's a loser and has been pronounced guilty 34 different times by a jury of his peers in New York. And so all hands on deck to try to reverse his convictions. And of course, Speaker Johnson, who declares himself to be a fundamentalist Christian and someone devout and who elevates the Bible above all else, has pledged to help Donald Trump absolve himself of these charges of cooking the books financially in order to cover up his $130,000 in hush money payments to his porn star erstwhile mistress. And disturbingly, Johnson said that he knows members of the Supreme Court and he knows how upset they are. And given that we're finally getting some real information about how the right wing of the court operates, I don't doubt him for one moment that he's been in touch with people like Alito and Thomas, and they are trying to figure out a way to reverse Donald Trump's convictions. So while they're attacking the rule of law and they're attacking the jury system, in fact, they're doing everything they can to compromise the judiciary and to destroy the rule of law in our country.
So you mentioned Alito and Thomas. In Supreme Court news, of course, Justice Clarence Thomas has finally acknowledged taking more free vacations paid for by the billionaire right-wing mega-donor Harlan Crowe. In a filing Friday, Thomas disclosed he accepted two trips in 2019, one to Indonesia, another to the Bohemian Grove in California. Last year, ProPublica revealed Thomas had failed to disclose at least 38 luxury trips gifted by Crowe and three other right-wing billionaires dating back decades. This comes as the wife of Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito faced criticism over an upside-down flag reportedly flown at the Alito home in 2021. I mean, it was the Alito's home, Justice Samuel Alito, in Virginia and in New Jersey. Both the upside-down flag that was flown at the insurrection in 2021 and also the appeal to heaven flag. It was Alito who blamed his wife. But apparently these flags had flown for a long time. What's the significance of this? You're a constitutional lawyer. What do you think should happen? And the fact that the Senate Judiciary Committee has subpoena power, what should they be doing? ProPublica won the Pulitzer Prize for their exposing of what's been going on with these justices. But what about the Senate Judiciary Committee?
Well, the first thing we have to observe, Amy, is that the ethics disclosure system, such as it is on the Supreme Court, doesn't work. It is only through this expert outside agitation by ProPublica and other groups that we're finally getting to the truth. But obviously, they don't have a meaningful ethics disclosure reporting system on the Supreme Court. The highest court in the land has the lowest ethical standards. It's the only court in the land where the judges or the justices have literally no mechanism where people can go to complain meaningfully about there being ethics violations. The second thing is that the laws and the rules that apply are essentially non-existent. Now, on Capitol Hill, a member of Congress is limited to $50 in terms of what we can accept from somebody who wants to take us out for lunch or dinner or offer us a gift. Most of the members that I know just don't take anything because they don't even want to go down that road and try to estimate what's worth $30 or $40 or $60 or what have you. Meantime, you've got Clarence Thomas accepting millions of dollars in gifts. In what world does that make any sense? How is that a gift as opposed to a payment or perhaps a bribe? And how is that a definition of friendship? I mean, you know, I've gone on trips with lots of my friends, but we go together. It's not like they pay for me hundreds of thousands of dollars to go somewhere else. So people have got to use some common sense about what's going on here. And that private corruption is an exact correlate to the public corruption that's taking place. They fly the American flag upside down. They fly the flag of the National Rifle Association right side up, and they hoist it way above the American flag. And we just saw that in the bump stock case, which is going to lead to some severely harmful consequences in the cities and towns and streets of America, as Justice Sotomayor warned. I mean, the whole reason that bump stocks and semi-automatic weapons, when put together, are treated or were treated like machine guns until the right wing of the court got involved is because of what we saw happen in Las Vegas, the most deadly massacre in American history, with 58 people murdered and more than 500 wounded and more than 1,000 rounds that were shot in 11 minutes. I mean, that's pretty extraordinary. And yet, Justice Thomas, with all of his little pictorial illustrations borrowed from right-wing sources, sets out to prove that, no, a machine gun, you just press the trigger once, but in the bump stock arrangement, you have to maintain some pressure on it. And that's why they overturned that regulation.
I want to ask you about another issue. This just broke this morning. The governor of Maryland planning today to pardon 175,000 marijuana convictions, wipe the records clean. The sweeping move by Governor Moore is expected to help about 100,000 people who are arrested on low-level drug charges. He said he's ecstatic that we have a real opportunity with what he said I'm signing to right a lot of historical wrongs, timing it with this week's Juneteenth federal holiday, June 19th, to mark the end of slavery in the United States. We're speaking to you, Congressmember Raskin, at your home in Tacoma Park, Maryland. You represent Maryland. Do you support what Governor Moore is doing?
Very much so. I'm extremely proud of our great governor, Wes Moore, for what he's doing and timing it with Juneteenth. It will undoubtedly be an emancipation in the lives of people who have to deal with all of the legal and social disabilities imposed by marijuana prohibition. And that's what this is all about. I mean, we've got an anti-prohibition principle in our Constitution. Prohibition did not work. That doesn't mean that alcohol and, you know, liquor use is great for everybody. But the way to get over an alcohol addiction is through the 12-step programs and challenging yourself to get over it, not throwing people in jail and building up organized crime and the mafia in America, which is what prohibition did. And it's the same thing with marijuana prohibition. Obviously, it didn't work. Millions of people, including lots of politicians and presidents, have admitted to using marijuana. And so why would we use marijuana as an opportunity to paste a lifelong disability on people's ability to, you know, go to college, to get jobs and so on? And so I'm proud of what Governor Moore is doing, at the same time that we take seriously the public health consequences of any kind of addiction. It's a serious thing.
If you can comment today, switching gears to Gaza. Yesterday, Congressmember Ro Khanna, your colleague from California, said he will not attend Prime Minister Netanyahu's joint address to Congress in July. He's joining people like Senator Bernie Sanders and others. Are you going to be joining them, Congressmember Raskin?
Well, I haven't figured that out yet. You know, my main commitment at this point is to see a ceasefire, to end the bloodshed, to get the hostages returned, and to surge humanitarian aid into Gaza. And our focus has to be on that. I'm not even necessarily convinced that Netanyahu is coming, and I want us to keep the focus on ending the violence right now.
What do you mean, Congressman Raskin, that you're not convinced he's coming?
Well, originally there was another date given. That date was changed. Now the date that has been given, I think, is July 24th. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, there is a war going on, and I hope there's a meaningful ceasefire process that's taking place. And I think we should keep our focus on that. And, you know, and then obviously I'll have to confront the whole question of whether, you know, I can assist some tiny forward momentum in terms of making peace and bringing an end to the bloodshed by going or by not going. I don't know the answer to that, but that's the kind of calculus I would have to make.
Congressmember Raskin, are you for a permanent ceasefire?
Well, I'm for a permanent cessation of all military hostilities. We've got to end these brutal cycles of violence and warfare, and that means we've got to address the underlying political problems, and we need to get onto the path to a real two-state solution, which has been American policy and also the international consensus for decades.
Congressman Raskin, also Bernie Sanders, the independent senator, has called for a cutoff of military aid to Israel. Are you in support of that?
I have not called for a cutoff of all military aid to Israel. I did vote against the last package because of the way that this war has been prosecuted. And I said from the beginning that Israel has a right to defend itself against the kinds of terrorist atrocities that we saw take place on October 7th, but only within the constraints of international law and international human rights law. And if you step outside of it, then that is a disaster for humanity.
Finally, President Biden's, you know, neck and neck with President Trump in running for president. There have been these uncommitted votes all over the country where people are saying they don't support President Trump, but they don't support President Biden because of his support for Netanyahu and Israel's war on Gaza. I'm wondering your thoughts as young people overwhelmingly have fled the Democrats when it comes to voting for Biden right now. African-Americans, you know, 1,000 religious leaders, black leaders wrote to President Biden and said they've never seen anything like this since the civil rights movement. Whole congregations criticizing President Biden for how he has supported Netanyahu in this war on Gaza. Your thoughts?
Well, look, I mean, we're living in a time of extraordinary fanaticism and illegality and threat to democracy and human rights. And we're obviously confronting that in America with the return of Donald Trump and his authoritarian movement, which traffics in racism, anti-Semitism, you name it. I believe that the Democratic Party must be on the side of the Constitution and the rule of law, and that includes international law and international human rights law, the laws of war. And I believe that's where the vast majority of the people are. And I believe that the Biden administration is honestly and aggressively working for a ceasefire and for a return of the hostages that are being held by Hamas right now. And I think that's where most people are. I think that people do not support a war that has resulted in lots of civilian casualties, a majority of them being women and children. And people do not support the terrorism of Hamas. People support the strategic defense and security of Israel. And people want to see progress out of the nightmare, which has been going on for decades now, these cycles of terror and war that leave lots of casualties, lots of death on both sides, and lots of hopelessness. And we know that Donald Trump offers absolutely no hope for progress there. And I believe that the Biden administration and the Democrats will be the way for us to get through this nightmare and to get to a ceasefire and then meaningful negotiations so we can break out of this. And in addition to the humanitarian imperative, which is so overwhelming on both sides, this war has also been an environmental nightmare. I mean, the world can't afford more wars like this. We have got to get people together across the world to be dealing with the reality of climate change, which is now a dagger at the throat of all humanity.
Jamie Raskin, we want to thank you for being with us, a Democrat representing Maryland's 8th Congressional District in the House of Representatives, author of the book Unthinkable. This is Democracy Now! Back in 20 seconds. Pavan Guru Pani Pita Mata Tarita Mahata Dis Rat Dui Dai Daya Khele Sagal Jagata Khele Sagal Jagata Guru by Brooklyn-based musician Sunny Singh. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Acclaimed author Arundhati Roy could soon face trial under India's contested anti-terror laws after an official from Prime Minister Narendra Modi's far-right BJP party gave the go-ahead for her prosecution. The charges against Roy stem from comments she made about Kashmir in 2010. Free speech advocates have expressed outrage over the persecution of Arundhati Roy, as well as other critics of Modi, who was sworn in last week to his third term as prime minister, albeit with BJP having lost its parliamentary majority in a stunning defeat. For more, we're joined by the award-winning Indian author and journalist Siddharth Deb. Welcome back to Democracy Now! We only have a few minutes. It may shock a lot of people who have followed Arundhati over the years, the remarkable award-winning author. Explain what she faces.
Well, she's been, this case is so convoluted, it's hard to say where it begins, where it ends, and that's the point. The process is the punishment. It's for a seminar that she took part in 2010. A right-wing sort of person lodged charges with the police. Most of them, some of them have expired. But this, the lieutenant governor of Delhi, who is very much a Modi man, has announced in the media that they're going to allow the police to pursue and to, you know, to file a charge sheet against her, and that they're going to do it under this notorious anti-terror law called UAPA, the Unlawful Activities Prevention Act. And that act, that there are many people in prison already under that. It's the process that is a torture. People have died in prison while waiting for trial, including Father Stan Swamy, the noted sort of Jesuit activist and priest. So that's what they are basically threatening Roy with. My understanding is that her lawyers haven't received anything official from the government yet. So this is all being played out in the media, and that is the whole point of it.
Why now? I mean, we're talking about something she said in 2010. This is 14 years later.
Yes. That's because the BJP is stunned by the electoral reverse. They have lost face. They have been in disarray. There's a lot of infighting going on. and they significantly lost Ayodhya, where the Ram temple was built. They have run out of ideas. This is Narendra Modi's attempt to show that everything is normal, and, you know, charging Roy is basically throwing his rabid attack dogs of Hindu nationalism, it's throwing them a bone so that they can get excited about it. It's an attempt to show that they are in control, they're in charge, nothing has changed.
Well, of course, we'll continue to follow this. Will Arundhati Roy be prosecuted in India? Siddharth Deb is the award-winning Indian author and journalist. His new nonfiction book is called Twilight Prisoners: The Rise of the Hindu Right and the Fall of India. His most recent novel, The Light at the End of the World. That does it for our show. We have a remarkable group of people who produce this program, and we thank them all very much. See our podcast at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we devote the entire show's focus to the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base Detention Center in Cuba. We start by talking with a filmmaker who just released a feature film on the subject.
Our guest is Felipe Diaz, the director and producer of I Am Gitmo, which puts a human face on the grotesque detention center at Guantanamo. We're then joined by Reverend Ron Stief, the executive director of the National Religious Campaign Against Torture.
The National Religious Campaign Against Torture, or NERCAT, is one of more than 300 organizations calling for the immediate, complete shutdown of this offshore, unaccountable, barbaric detention center.
Stay with us.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer. It's been 22 years since the U.S. opened its prison at the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base in Cuba. Specifically, it was 4 months after the September 11th, 2001 attacks on the World Trade Center. We saw images of men and boys arriving there, bound and hooded, in orange jumpsuits, confined indefinitely, without charges, legal process, or trials. And it was not long after that we began hearing reports that the U.S. government was using torture, and even that prisoners were dying there. Again, without even being charged with any crime, let alone tried by any court. The U.S. justified its tactics as necessary to win the, quote, war on terror, end quote. But U.N. experts and human rights activists globally have called for the U.S. to close the facility due to its, quote, unrelenting human rights violations, end quote. In 2009, President Obama took steps to close Guantanamo, but in 2018, Trump signed an executive order to keep it open. President Biden was then elected, signaling he'd close it, but the subject has been largely ignored ever since. Today, 30 prisoners remain. Our guest is Felipe Diaz, a filmmaker who is shining a spotlight on the humanity of the men and boys who have lived, and some who have died, in Guantanamo Bay Prison. His latest film, the award-winning I Am Gitmo, is a story about a Muslim schoolteacher in Afghanistan who was accused of being a terrorist and then imprisoned in Guantanamo Bay Prison without charges or hope of being released. Philippe Diaz is not only the writer and director of I Am Gitmo, but he is also the founder of Cinema Libre Studio, a boutique film company created in 2003 with a consortium of partners to provide an alternative structure for intelligent, independent films to get developed, financed, produced, and distributed. Philippe Diaz, a warm welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here. You know, I have a great admiration for the work you do. So glad to be here.
Oh, thank you. Well, I know filmmaking is such an investment of time, energy, and of course, money. What inspired you and your team to undertake the project of making a feature film about Guantanamo Bay?
Well, you know, so it's a long answer, but I'll make it short for you. The issue is, you know, I created 33 years ago this production distribution company that I still run here in Los Angeles, and we are specialized in doing social political films, feature film documentaries. We distributed probably 300 of this film, this type of film since the beginning, and the reason is that we believe and we know for a fact that movie can make a difference in the world. You know, since we have been doing that, we have been tackling every single, you know, you can imagine social issue with our films. You pick a subject, and I'm sure we distributed a movie about it. So, and we saw during all these years that, in fact, you know, it makes a difference be-